Dear God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. When my mother died in 2011, one of the items she left was an old rowing shell. It was thrown in the moving van, trucked to Vermont, and promptly put in storage. Until last spring, when it occurred to me that I might be able to learn to row. The shell was refurbished, and slowly and clumsily, I started rowing. First in our cove, close to shore, and then later venturing further out. As the summer bloomed, so did my love of rowing, and each morning, when the wind was favorable, i.e. virtually non-existent, I'd slip onto the water before the sun came up. Between our house and Shelburne, which is near the Shelburne Town Beach, and Shelburne Farms, there really isn't anything at all. A mostly uninhabited house at Quaker Smith Point, but that's it. Shells are notoriously tipsy, so balance is a big part of rowing. Given that one is always moving backwards, maintaining ease and control is essential. My son-in-law, who is an avid rower, told me that when his crew was practicing in college, their coach told them to close their eyes to better become one with the water. I confess that I never quite had the courage to go blind, to trust that I wouldn't capsize or crash into something as I relinquished any of my senses. I was still trying to get three good strokes in a row. But what amazed me every morning before sunrise, farther from shore than I probably should have been, was the enveloping silence. A lone gull called now and then, but it was a bit early even for them. They are wont to roost on shore rocks until the sun casts its first warming rays. I'm not sure I've ever experienced such utter silence. It was holy and it was consuming, not just because it was a relief, which it certainly was, but because it seemed pregnant, full of something or someone who in our normal lives of motors and hums is constantly obliterated. Crossing my oars in front of me, I'd sit quietly and float on the water that was itself waking as the first rustles of a breeze gently combed its glassy surface into ripples. I tend to revel in silence and solitude. But let's face it, not all silence is welcome or comforting. Choosing to be alone is entirely different from feeling lonely and abandoned. When the silence is not a blessing but a dagger, when it speaks not of sanctuary but of torment and desperation, we don't feel peaceful. We're apt to feel, as Job did, cursed and convicted. There have been times in all our lives when we felt utterly alone, bereft not only of human love and companionship, but that of God. Times when we have prayed and heard nothing. Times when we have worn the carpet thin with our pacing and been left only dizzy and scared. Times when the only sound we hear is the echo of our own wailing. The passage that Jensa just read comes about halfway through the book of Job, and in it, Job is replying to his friends who have come to give him advice. Essentially, their counsel is that he confess his sins and admit that he has been bad, which of course prompts us to recall the adage, with friends like this, who needs enemies? Job's desperate response to them is both protest and lament. What he seeks first is an adjudicatory solution. He wants to bring his case to God's court and argue in his own defense. I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn what he would answer and understand what he would say to me. There, an upright person could reason with God, and I should be acquitted forever before my judge. Well, intending no disrespect to the attorneys and judge present here this morning, it feels as though Job's plan will likely fall upon deaf ears. Upright though he may be and undeserving of the treatment he is receiving, it may be that in the human court of law, despite its usefulness in earthly disputes, this argument may fall short of truth and mercy. As Christine Blasey Ford, ask Christine Blasey Ford how she would feel about this. There is no guarantee that speaking one's case, however truthful it may be, will result in affirmation and acquittal. Sadly, the truth of Dr. Ford's testimony was ultimately not the issue. As has happened with so many women who have summoned the courage to speak of things unspeakable, uttering the truth is no guarantee of justice. For decades, victims of sexual assault perpetrated by the Catholic Church brought their accusations to light and were summarily ignored and often shamed. What Job suspected in his heart is not that the truth would set him free, but that it didn't matter, that he didn't matter. I suspect that the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee did, for the most part, believe Dr. Ford. The toxic suspicion is that the majority of them simply didn't care. So too did the hierarchy of the Catholic Church value those in power more than their victims. Job's torment and protest is our own, his frustration, something with which many of us can identify these days. Would that we could plead our case before God and that we would be vindicated and justice would roll down like the waters and righteousness like an ever-rolling stream. What is Job left with in his frustration and agony? God's absence, God's silence. He is utterly alone, and the reality is deafening, just as it is for us in our own times of grief and desperation and depression. We may try to run from the hollowness, fill the silence with noise, the stillness with shopping or frantic activity, the pain with numbing substances of all sorts. But what if the silence is precisely where God is? As Thomas Edward Frank has suggested, what if God is saying enough already? What if God has taken off the robes and left the bench? God is hiding, covered in darkness, hand over ears, waiting. For us to be quiet. As the midterm elections approach, we find ourselves in a season of way too much noise. It feels as though there are no spaces between the words, doesn't it? No punctuation, that what bombards us is one long snake of letters, the meaning of which, the truth of which, is hard to discern. Our inclination is to withdraw, like God, to cover our ears and wait for it to be over. The suggestion here is that it is precisely in the darkness and the silence that we will meet God roosting like a ruffled bird on our broken hearts and weary souls. What is called for is not a relinquishment of connection, but a recalibration of our true north, a realignment with God. There is an ancient Greek legend that when the gods made the human species, it fell to them to argue about the answers of life and where they should put them so that human beings would actually search for them. So one god said, "Let's put the answers on the top of a mountain. They will never look for them there." "No," said the others, "they'll find them right away." Another of the gods said, "Let's put them in the center of the earth. They will never look for them there." "No," said the others, "they'll find them right away." Then another spoke, "Let's put them in the bottom of the sea. They will never look for them there." "No," said the others, "they will find them right away." And silence fell. And after a while, another god spoke, "We can put the answers to life within them. They will never look for them there." And so they did. This is the concept of the indwelling God, not, I would suggest, only in each of us, but in all creation. And how each of us taps into this ground of being, this holy vein, this wellspring of God's love, is largely what our work in this life is about. One scorching afternoon in June of 2011, our daughter Eliza and her husband Rose house in Charlotte caught fire. A plumber had been sweating a pipe and neglected to stay on site for the requisite 2 hours after using a blowtorch. The good news is that Eliza and Roe were not living there at the time, and the house was sparsely furnished. As soon as I received the call from the plumber alerting me to smoke in the walls, I drove quickly down Greenbush Road from where I could see, to my disbelief, this huge tower of black smoke down at the lake. By the time I got there, there were 85 firefighters from 9 different departments and almost as many EMTs, because the temperature outside the burning structure was 93 degrees, and the crews were suffering. It was so hot in the building that the firefighters could only stay inside for 2 minutes. We would learn later that had they known the actual temperature in the house, they would never have been permitted to enter. Copper pipes were melted, and they do so at 1,984 degrees. The fires in crematoriums are at 1,600 degrees. Amazingly, the house was not burned. The fire went up into the attic and was trapped there because the roof was slate. Slate was installed on roofs in the 19th century for the simple reason that rock doesn't burn. So the fire was starved of oxygen. Had the roof been made of any other material, it would have burst forth and consumed the 1850 house in a matter of minutes. The presenting issue, however, that afternoon was that the firefighters couldn't actually see the exact location of the fire in the attic because it was impossible to see through all the smoke. One by one, they stumbled down the stairs, gasping for breath and shaking their heads as black smoke billowed from the windows. Then my friend Art Cohen, co-founder of the Lake Maritime Museum and a deep sea diver and also a member of the North Ferrisburg Fire Department, went up into the attic and located the fire that was subsequently extinguished. Sitting together on the lawn hours later, He, exhausted, sweaty, and black with soot, I wrung out from anxiety, asked him how he found the fire. I closed my eyes, he said, and went on to explain that he'd treated it like a dive. When you're at the bottom of the lake or any deep sea situation, you're in a pitch black environment. You have to join the flow, he said. If you open your eyes and struggle, you will rarely succeed and you will definitely get dizzy and sick. What one needs in emergency situations, he suggested, is precisely that which is elusive, patience. Only when he closed his eyes and let go of the notion that through sheer will he would be able to see, could he actually find his way. As Job did, there are times in all our lives when we beat on the door of God's chamber and hear only the bolt being thrown from the other side. Our reaction can be to scream louder, to pound harder, to protest, "Wait, you need to listen to me." As if our words and arguments, our wailings, will prove our vindication and that God will be convinced by our arguments. Or we can close our eyes and take a deep breath and entertain the alarming and frightening notion that somehow, somewhere, sitting over in the corner in the darkness, smoke, and silence, God is waiting for us, waiting to enfold us in wings of mercy and love, and simply be with us for as long as it takes, and then quietly lead us as we venture forth into the world to tread more gently, to speak more calmly and assuredly, to spread the gospel of peace. Grace and peace.